Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Hello, and welcome back to the Obesity Medicine Association's podcast, Obesity, a Disease. I'm your host, Dr. Allison Rhodes, and I'm excited to continue our series exploring how obesity impacts different areas of medicine. Today, we're joined again by Dr. Allison Bailey, Chief of Cardiology for Centennial Heart at Park Ridge in Chattanooga, Tennessee. She is also Physician Director of Cardiovascular Disease for HCA Healthcare. In this episode, we'll take a deeper dive into cardiology, focusing on the key cardiovascular risks and conditions we see in patients with obesity. Dr. Bailey, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This is such an important topic. I'm glad we're addressing it today.
I'm curious if you could share with us some of the unique challenges you face when you're diagnosing or imaging patients with obesity.
Yeah, I think this is a really important topic, and it's not always thought about because, you know, if I wasn't an echocardiographer, for instance, I probably wouldn't think about it very much. But when you think about getting an echo, which is a test that I use every day in order probably, you know, 10 times a day in most patients that I see, because most of what I talk about to a patient depends on knowing what their cardiac structure looks like, both the heart function, as well as the diastolic function, as well as the heart valves, and then the pulmonary pressures. So when you think about echo, that's an ultrasound-based procedure, and the amount of adiposity or fat tissue between the chest wall and where the heart sits really depends on the quality of the images. So as body mass index goes up, particularly if it's central adiposity, it really does reduce the quality of those images. And in women, sometimes that makes things even more difficult because of breast tissue. And so that really is a big driver. Now we've got things that we can do. We can use contrast media, which is not the same iodinated contrast as we use with a CT scan. It doesn't affect renal function or anything, but it really helps us with looking at ejection fraction, for instance, but it doesn't help quite as much sometimes with looking at valve disease. Then if I think of another test that I use a lot is CT scans. So we do calcium scores a lot to sort of help risk stratify patients for coronary artery disease. But we're also doing a lot of non-invasive angiography, looking at coronary arteries with CT. Well, the larger your body mass index, the more radiation that you receive with things like a CT scan. And then if I'm thinking about something like a CTA to look at or obstructive coronary artery disease and flow, I really do have to get heart rate control. And sometimes we know that as body mass goes up, that's associated with an increased heart rate. So that becomes more challenging. And then if I think about the next most common test I do really is stress testing. And, you know, we frequently use imaging-based stress testing. And if we're doing things like nuclear cardiology, we also see increases in radiation dose as body mass index goes up. MRI is another test that we use. Now, I love MRI because it doesn't have radiation associated with it, but body size and body morphology really can limit who can get into the MRI scanners. And then the scanners are really a circle that patients go into, and they have to have a magnet on top of the abdomen. And so sometimes if our patients carry a lot of weight in the middle, they can't fit in our scanners. And so you really have to think about not only sort of what is their overall weight, but what does their waist circumference look like when you're thinking about doing either a CT or a cardiac MRI.
How do you feel like obesity impacts the safety or the success of cardiac procedures like stents, bypass surgery, or even a valve replacement?
Yeah, so I think, you know, in the stent world, we've gotten pretty good at most of the time now we can use a radial approach, meaning we go from the arm versus the groin. And that really does lower risk considerably in patients as body mass index goes up. So when we were using primarily a femoral approach, for percutaneous coronary interventions and coronary angiograms, the risk with obesity is considerably higher than the risk with someone with a lower body mass index, because you can have you're more likely to have a bleed, or specifically a retroperitoneal bleed, because access is more difficult, because again, you've got more subcutaneous fat before you get to the artery. But if we can do a radial approach, which is, I would say, the standard in most labs in the United States now, that risk really goes down. The success of the procedure generally is not affected as much by weight. It really is the access point. But when you start thinking about things like cardiac surgery, particularly when you require a sternotomy, and that's one of the things that's required frequently for bypass surgery and valve replacements, although not all valve replacements in 2025, but that the risk of recovery goes up. So sedation's a higher risk. There's an increased risk of things like perioperative pneumonias. Rehab is harder, and sometimes those patients will require a prolonged rehab stay or hospital stay. And then the risk of perioperative atrial fibrillation is considerably increased in this group.
Sounds like there have been a lot of good advances that are certainly helping to mitigate some of the risks associated with these procedures for individuals with obesity who are at such a higher risk of even having these conditions and requiring these procedures to begin with. How do you see obesity affecting the long-term outcomes for individuals either who undergo these procedures or who have heart disease?
Yeah, so, you know, I think if I think about it in the immediate perioperative period, we kind of already talked about that. And then if we look at sort of that intermediate and long-term risk, we know that there BMI is strongly associated with cardiac events. So if you take somebody who's never had an event, as your body mass index goes up, you're more likely to have both a myocardial infarction, develop heart failure, and to have cardiovascular mortality. And we've known those things for a long time. If you think about somebody who has established disease, like coronary artery disease requiring surgery, valve replacement, those things hold true and the risk is even higher. So I think that, you know, weight, and again, if you look at weight, weight overall is a strong predictor. But then when you look at specifically visceral adiposity, or peri-aortic adiposity, pericardiac adiposity, those things are also strongly associated with increased risk.
Shifting gears a little bit from procedures, there's been a lot of excitement about some of the newer medications that have become FDA approved, not only for treatment of obesity, but also for the intersection with cardiovascular disease. How do you find drugs like GLP-1 receptor agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors changing the landscape of your practice?
Yeah, I think that's the most exciting thing that's happening in cardiology today. You know, so we've known for quite a while, you know, going all the way back to the LEADER trial, that if you have type 2 diabetes and you have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, the GLP-1 receptor agonists are associated with a reduction in cardiac events as well as mortality. And so that's been true for years. Sort of what's the more exciting news is now the SELECT trial was really the first trial that showed if you don't have diabetes, so a group of people with established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, you know, prior heart attack, peripheral arterial disease, prior stroke, and those patients get a GLP-1 receptor agonist, they have a 20% relative risk reduction in cardiac events. So that is very exciting. So this group of medicines have gone from being diabetes meds to now being drugs that reduce cardiovascular risk in patients with established cardiovascular disease. Now, the most exciting thing, I think, in my world is we're also seeing benefits in heart failure, particularly heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And when you look at the GLP-1 receptor agonists, you know, we've now got multiple trials that are showing improvements in functional capacity, which is really what our HFpEF patients talk about. I can't go to the grocery store. You know, I can't go and play with my grandchild. I can't go and do all the fun things that I want to do because I get so short of breath. And so improvements in functional capacity, I think, are the most important thing that my patients are looking for with heart failure. And so we're seeing that with the GLP-1 receptor agonist. And then, you know, I think also in the world of obstructive sleep apnea, we're seeing considerable benefits in people that are already on CPAP therapy or even those who aren't. Then I think if you go outside the GLP-1 receptor agonist, you know, we're seeing benefits. We're also seeing weight loss with those drugs, which are, you know, makes people have additional benefits, reduction in, you know, improvements in diabetes control, reduction in arthritis, you know, things like joint replacements are going down. But when you think about the SGLT2 inhibitors, I think that's the other class of medicines that really have a benefit in this group. So, you know, again, another class of diabetes drugs that we saw when we gave SGLT2 inhibitors to individuals with type 2 diabetes, we saw a 40% reduction in the development of heart failure. And that tended to be a class effect. And so we started studying these drugs in heart failure. So now they're indicated not only in heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, but heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And they really have been a paradigm-changing drug for that disease. So they're now considered one of the four pillars of care for both of those disease processes. And we do see small amounts of weight reduction with the SGLT2 inhibitors. So I think, you know, these diabetes drugs that have now come into other areas have been incredibly exciting. And I'm so looking forward to what we're going to continue to find out with this class.
I couldn't agree more that there's so much excitement about what's coming down the pipeline and being able to have a toolkit that has so many different tools to help advocate for our patients and get them to that, you know, functional capacity that we know is going to let them live long, fulfilled, healthy lives is what gets me up in the morning every day. And it sounds like it gets you up too. That being said, we know that some of our patients still need to lose or would benefit from losing a significant amount of weight to really have that degree of functional improvement. And although our GLP-1 receptor agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors certainly help patients with weight loss, sometimes patients do need other interventions. What role do you find that bariatric or metabolic surgery plays in reducing cardiovascular risk for your patients?
Yeah, and I think this is a really important point. You know, we've known about bariatric surgery for a long time. I think it's still incredibly underutilized for a variety of reasons. One is sort of the stigma of patients thinking about, oh my gosh, do I really want to go through a surgery just to lose weight? And then, you know, the fact that it's not covered by all the insurers. So bariatric surgery in patients who are at cardiovascular risk or have established cardiovascular disease absolutely lowers risk. So we've known this for a while. When you look at both prospective randomized trials, as well as things like meta-analysis, putting together a bunch of trials, we see improvement in cardiac events, as well as improvements in cardiovascular mortality, because all of the risk factors get better. So, you know, diabetes control gets better, blood pressure control gets better, the likelihood of developing steatohepatitis gets better. So sort of all the things I think about that are adverse risk prognosticators for my cardiovascular patients improve with bariatric surgery. Now, I think in the cardiovascular space, we don't refer nearly enough patients to bariatric surgery. And so that's the other thing I would encourage everybody out there to think about. You know, if it's a patient that's really not been successful in losing weight by whatever method they've tried, think about bariatric surgery early, because it, again, is a process. It's not like you refer and they go in and get surgery the next day. It's sort of, you know, it's like everything else. You have to work up towards that. And it's not right for all patients, but for the patients that can get there, it absolutely improves their long-term cardiac outcome.
It sounds like you're certainly supportive of a team-based approach to care and advocating for your patients in terms of getting them that supportive team structure where they can have specialists from each domain helping them, again, achieve those ideal health outcomes. How do you feel like you maximize that team-based approach, whether it's involving other cardiologists, primary care physicians, obesity medicine specialists, or bariatric surgeons to help your patients with long-term success?
You know, I think as long as there's communication between care teams, which can be incredibly difficult in today's world, but I think as long as there's communication and, you know, the message I send to the patient is, we all want you to have the best outcome. Now, I may start a medicine that does more than just affect your cardiovascular system, but I'm starting it because of an improved cardiac outcome. So GLP-1 receptor agonists, for instance, you know, they've still not been utilized nearly as much in cardiology as they should be. And some of that is fear of, you know, stepping on someone's toes in another specialty is what we hear when we ask cardiologists why they don't start these medicines. But, you know, I think that shouldn't be the case. And I don't find I've ever had someone say, oh, I really don't want you starting a medicine that improves a patient's outcome because you're not an endocrinologist or you're not a primary care clinician. And so I just think communication back via the patient, as well as, you know, from our notes that we send to each other or picking up the phone and talking to each other, is so incredibly important. We're all managing these really complicated patients and we have to play together on the same team.
So we certainly know that obesity is a complex chronic disease. Sometimes I know, especially in my clinic, when I see a patient for the first time, they can be entirely overwhelmed with the new diagnoses I'm introducing them to, whether it's metabolic syndrome or insulin resistance. Maybe they already know that they have high blood pressure and type 2 diabetes. What would be one message that you would give to one of your patients when you're meeting them for the first time and really starting to build that relationship with them in terms of your longitudinal care relationship?
Yeah, I think that's really important. You know, it's overwhelming for all of us, I think, when we start thinking about making changes to improve our health. So I say start at the beginning. You know, if you're not doing any physical activity, let's start with 5 minutes of activity. And I tell myself this some days, you know, if it's a day that I'm tired and I've got a million things going on, I'm like, 5 minutes is better than 0 minutes, and make our goal to improve that every week. And then, you know, the other thing I would say is that we're a team. We're going to see each other frequently. We're going to work through this, and we're going to work with all the other members on the team to make sure we get you where we want to be. It's not going to be overnight, but we're going to get there.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. A big thank you to Dr. Allison Bailey for joining us and sharing your expertise. Ultimately, recognizing and treating obesity helps us deliver safer care, have better outcomes, and have healthier lives for our patients. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Obesity, a Disease. For more information about obesity medicine podcasts and other valuable resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode and want to listen regularly, head over to iTunes where you can subscribe, rate, and leave us a much appreciated review. The views expressed in this episode are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please join us again for our next episode of Obesity, a Disease.